slide then, Lloyd Sokvitney. He's a senior manager digital strategies at the State Library of Tasmania. While at the State Library, Lloyd has overseen the development of Tasmania Online, a comprehensive Tasmanian web indexing service. Service Tasmania Online, the unified cross-jurisdictional government services portal for Tasmania. Our Digital Island, who's been doing a lot, a website repository and preservation service, and Stores, an open digital repository for Tasmanian electronic publications. In February 2006, Lloyd was awarded the Robert D. Williamson Award by VALA for his contribution to information technology development in libraries. Looks like we're going to have a very interesting presentation, quite a one that will shake things up a bit, I think. So over to Lloyd.
Thank you, Phil. What I want to talk about today, sorry, I'll just get my timing organized, is really what I've shown up on the slide there, where I think users have two choices in front of them. What I want to do is see if we can't get those arrows pointing in the same direction. Why I think they don't point in the same direction, I think, is illustrated by these two slides. I think your ILMS, as far as the user's concerned, is quite inhospitable, distant, and uninviting. That's Alcatraz, by the way. And this is how they look at the web. Very inviting, friendly, easy to use, something very comfortable. Now, the reality is quite different, but I think perceptions are what matter in this case. And that's what many people see and think. They'd just rather go and Google something. So today what I want to cover are is four things. I want to talk about user choices in general, and particularly how they affect the online environment. Talk about redesigning the OPAC, and there's a lot of discussion going on globally about that. Bed some of that in our real-life experience with what we're doing at the State Library, and then finally come up with some conclusions based on where we're at the present time. Users have always had choices. In the old days, 10, 15 years ago, there were choices between libraries and bookshops, and because libraries were free, we were usually a hands-down winner. Along comes the web and online services generally, and I think there's just a range of choices now when users are looking for information, resources, etc. We've got library OPACs now, and we have online versions of those, of course. We have other library resources, quite often not available through the OPAC, but through other services provided by a given library. It could be an images database, it could be a digitized heritage collections, etc. So we have a couple of choices within the library world. Outside of the library world, then, we have web search engines, and we all know about Google and a whole range of other ones. And we also have web services that can range from bookshops through to maps, directories, and importantly now they're starting to interconnect, or as they call it in the IT world, to get mashups going, where you can have search engines interacting with directories and maps and all sorts of things, producing quite unexpected but quite often quite useful results. The other thing I'd say about that, and there are ways to look at this, but I think the real statement I'd make is that libraries aren't winning in this competition between us and what else is happening on the web. And I think most of us would say, well, that's a pity, because the OPAC is in fact so much better. It's got all this high quality data, and most of you know all about that. It's got a sense of neutrality, which we tend to forget about, but I think is quite important nonetheless. We don't have a commercial bias like most things do on the web. Finally, we all emphasize, I think, quite often, at least amongst ourselves, how professional we are. And I'm not having a go at us. We are professional, but I'm not sure whether that is enough in its own right. Those three things together aren't enough. So why are the competitors winning? Well, the really important thing is the first stop point. They actually reflect user behavior. There's a very important book about websites called Don't Make Me Think by Steve Krug, and I'd really recommend that. I always recommend that whenever I talk about these things. He brings up a very important concept, which is called satisficing. What that means is that users will tend to pick the first thing in a list, which even closely approximates what they're looking for, rather than going through and evaluating all the alternatives and go through multiple pages. This is why getting items to the top of the list on the first page, why ranking is so important, because this is how users react. The second thing that our competitors are doing is they're providing a range of pertinent information. It's not just the dry textual information about a book and its title and its author. They're providing book covers, reviews, ratings, etc. And these things are actually helping users in making their choices. What both those things together, I think, as well as other individual components, is that they indicate to me that they're treating the user as a very important part of the process, a partner of the process. They allow personalization, allow interaction, but what it is, and this comes back, I think, to some of the business drivers around the web, is that you don't succeed on the web, you don't become successful and remain successful unless you're getting users to come and use your service. And to do that, you actually have to be relevant to what they do. And I think there are some issues which I would call just some cold facts of life. For most of our users, near enough is in fact good enough. The experience itself is as important as the result. And I'm not talking here about making it glitzy, but I am talking about making it interesting, full of additional information that they do find relevant, and making the whole process one that's pleasant rather than difficult. It's also about real user behaviors, and here it really is, and I think Google is one of the first people to popularize this, which is to hide the complexity. We do have to do lots of things. We have to be highly professional and sophisticated, but we can't show that. As far as the user's concerned, it should be as simple to use as, in fact, Google. Finally, against this sort of commercial environment, which a lot of search services are now working against, we have to look at the issue of how do we divert resources, how do we create the sort of tool that we want to provide for our clients. And really, when you look at the costs of cataloging, and I had a quick look recently just to see what I could find, and a recent study, I think, out of California suggested it was it $58 or $68 US per item, the catalog. And that's just certainly too expensive to compete in today's marketplace. And the real issue, I think, ultimately, is they'll vote with their feet. And on the left is a picture of ROPAC, which I think is no worse than many. There are probably other better ones, of course, but I think compare that to Amazon, but there are so many resources out there on the web. And I don't know many users who would really choose something that's hard. They have to know the difference between a title index and an author index. You don't need to know very many things to use Google, or to use Amazon, sorry, in this case. So if we come into the question of redesigning the OPAC, I think we need to look at what drives that OPAC. And in this case, the main driver is, of course, the Integrated Library Management System. And that's, in fact, what an OPAC was. It was really developed as a tool to access the content of your LMS, the stuff you acquire and catalog. Now, the trouble with ILMS products is that they're very slow to move forward. Enhancements are very periodic, and they just do not have the capacity in the ILMS marketplace to move as quickly as other types of tools, discovery tools, do. And if there's somebody here who thinks they have an ILMS product that's keeping up with the rest of the world, I'd certainly be pleased to talk to them later about it. The real question, though, I think, is changing the goalposts, so to speak, and looking at what we're trying to do. An integrated library management system made sense in the 70s, and it made even more sense in the 80s when we could deliver it, but it's starting to make less sense in the 90s and certainly after 2000. The data is there, and we can do things with it like move it out. The best way to look at that is to think of your whole cataloging and library system as something that has a three-tier architecture. It has data underneath, it has things that access that data in the middle, and then you have what you deliver to your client at the top layer. An integrated library system has bound those together. There was only one application, more or less, in the middle, and that was the ILMS. The reality is you can have lots of different applications in the middle, delivering lots of different sorts of outcomes. What you then have to do, though, and be sure you can do, is uncouple the data from the application. So just because you create data within your LMS doesn't mean you have to keep it within there. The data should be used by any and all applications that we want to use it. And this, in fact, is a really important step to make. We own the data, we can do what we like with it. So if you can move that data outside of the LMS and use other systems, a whole new world opens up to you. You can use software that was developed on the web, or at least acknowledged and been enhanced to meet the web, and is moving as quickly as the web. Basically, all those points up there add up to two important things. When you're outside of the LMS, you can actually do more, and that's just a fundamental thing. What you can do, I think, is up to us, but you can certainly do a lot more than you can within an LMS. Equally importantly, and a change, I think, is a fact of life, and once you're outside of the LMS, you can continue to change, be more flexible, add things, because there's almost no debate, I think, that the future of information discovery over the next 10 years is going to keep moving, keep changing. And what we think is the answer today and tomorrow won't be the answer in 5 and 10 years. So change is not something we just do once and solve the problem. We have to continue to move on. So just to start off, or to move on to, sorry, a real life example of trying to do this. At the State Library of Tasmania, we are actually moving our data out of the traditional ILMS, out of our ILMS, and creating a new search service. We've been out to tender and now acquired the software to do that. And what we're doing is using this external search engine software to index the data once we've exported it out of our database, out of our cataloging system. We also can then use that software to deliver the interface. And the acquisition process, the tender process for that, yielded a number of products that could do it. So this isn't just a case of choosing only one. There are many products out there that can do it. Because we're exporting the data out, an OPAC also does other things like access holdings data and circulation data, which we can't export all the time because it's very dynamic. So what you can do, though, with this type of software is then link back into your LMS to get that sort of data whenever you need it. So this is the basis of the system that we're now developing. So to look at the issues that we had, this is my favorite slide because we don't have any software issues. Even when we were doing our prototype, we could take 500,000 bib records using an open source search engine called Lucene and re-index the entire database in about an hour. And if any of you have been involved doing that on LMS, it usually takes a weekend, if not a couple of weeks. So the software that's out there is just now incredibly powerful to do the sorts of things that we struggle with. The really important question are the design is, it really is, how do you actually design this new style of OPAC once you've got the data out of the LMS? There aren't really any precedents in the library world, although recently in the last year or so, a few are starting to emerge. But what we've done in the State Library is actually gone back to look at our users and how they look for information, what's their actual behavior like. And what they found was that they're essentially people who either look for something that they know what they're looking for, and OPACs have catered for that for a long time. But the majority of them don't do that. They actually browse. They're not sure what they're looking for. They want to be exposed to a whole range of content and then make a choice as they're browsing along. They do this physically along the shelves. They look at book jackets. They look at recent returns. They hardly ever just look in the catalog to find that specific item they're looking for. So what we want is, I think most people these days call faceted navigation or guided navigation, there are a number of terms, is a way for the OPAC to deliver and expose, if you like, its content to the user just by giving them easy choices to make. In this process, though, it's not just a case of making it easy to browse. You also then have to provide them with some sort of criteria-based listing or, if you like, ranking of the result sets. I know of one LMS system who ranks responses to queries on the basis of the last item added to the database gets to be the first item on the list of results, and I can't see how that has any value to anyone and why we put up with it for so long. I think ranking is critical for the satisfying reasons I talked about before, but I'm not going to say it's easy because we don't know necessarily how to rank as yet. But I think we do have to rank. Finally, we have to provide supplementary information. For example, when I watched the people in Hobart Lending Library choosing books when they came through the door, the first thing they did was look at the returns trolley. And that's sort of a recommendations engine, if you like. They're saying that if somebody else borrowed this, I probably want to borrow it as well. Now, that's the sort of supplementary information. Again, I don't know for sure, but I think it's the sort of information that we need to be considering and trying and seeing if we can find the types of information that will really help our users. The last dot point there is probably the most important one. We don't know all the answers. We don't know very many of the answers to this sort of thing. And we have to do lots of trial and error. And the thing about trial and error, particularly in the libraries, is you just can't say that and then not do it. You have to continue to change, evolve. So the first version of our replacement OPAC, when it goes live, is we're calling it, in fact, version one, and we're expecting to go through 6 monthly major revisions and versions over umpteen years, if you like, until we know what we're doing and we get results-based, users-based information to back up what we're choosing at the moment. I should add, though, too, there are some precedents out there, but they don't come from libraries. They come from successful websites like Toys R Us, Amazon, etc. How they use and provide faceted navigation for their clients. Because this is the hard commercial world they're working in, I think if it works for them, there's probably a pretty good chance it'll work for us as well. So design issues lead on to, in fact, data issues. We have lots of data issues as well. If we're going to provide facets, ways to chunk our data together, if you like, do we have the right data to do that? And if so, how can we use it? Do we correct it, modify it, et cetera? Partly, and I'll show you that very quickly in a minute, we do have a fair bit of good data, so that's a good answer to that question. We don't have all the right data, but we have some of it. Some of it, though, the next question is, does it make sense when you pull it out and expose it and use it in this new browsing environment? And that's a harder one, because sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. For example, you can pull out the chronological subdivision out of LCH headings and end up with a very nice era facet where you can let people choose by, you know, 19th century, 1945 dash, et cetera. They pop out quite nicely out of the data, out of the catalog. But then you also find variations where you have 20th century dash and 1900 dash. And they're very confusing for a user. How does one make sense of both those options? Because to me, they're the same option. So we may have to do a bit more work in modifying that data and convert them, if you like, to the same language. The other thing, though, is where do we get the data that we don't have? Because there's lots that we don't. And the good news, though, is that once you're outside of the ILMS, it's very easy to get it from other places. Libraries in Australia is an example of this, and we're doing the same. You can get book jackets off Amazon, off other places. There's other information you can get out there and use it within your web without any great problem. There's also other places within your ILMS and within your other systems that you can probably get the data that you need from. One of our relevance ranking criteria has got to be something to do with popularity, and we have three types of criteria at least we can use, which is the number of copies we hold for something, the number of loans that are on it, there's another one anyway. We can take those, develop some sort of algorithm, and come up with a popularity ranking for it, and that's just a very easy pull from the circulation data system. But it would be very interesting, too, to get that type of data from elsewhere. And I think library systems themselves aren't the only source, or one individual library isn't the only source for this sort of information. Collectively, we could provide and share lots of that type of information. The final answer to where we get the data from comes back to, well, let's create it. If we don't have good data to meet a certain facet, well, then let's get the cataloging department to create it. It's nice and easy just to say that. And I think that's, in fact, a good answer, because I think that's what the catalogers can do and should do. But I think we have to do it in a very cost-effective way. And it may also mean, in due course, that we have to stop doing something else part of our cataloging record to make time and space available to create the data that our users do need. Now, I'm just very quickly going to go through a prototype, and I know you can't see it. I'm really just rushing through this to show you basically how a different type of OPAC can work. What I've highlighted in the top three red circles are there are the facets we're probably going to go live with. We're going to go live on the 1st of February when we've done more usability testing than we have at the moment. But there are format, genre, and topic. So, and the other ones are just options we're playing with on the page. If someone, for example, though, were just to click on the option for DVDs under format, the top left, in real life it is pretty fast too, not quite as fast as this, but it's surprisingly fast. Whoops. Is a list of the DVDs that we have in our collection. What's going on here? Okay, and then if you go to the arrow on your right, you'll see that under the topic there's feature film. So someone could choose, oh, well, I want DVDs, but I'm also interested in feature films. And this immediately reduces it down to 211 items. And you can see in the top left the two facets that have been chosen. Must be careful not to touch that. Then if they choose region Australia as the next facet, suddenly we've come down to 18 items, and you can see that the user, just by browsing, has now built up quite a sophisticated search query for DVDs, feature films, and Australia, and can then go and choose what they want from there. Importantly, if the user now decides, well, I'm interested in anything that has feature films and Australia, and not format DVD, which is up at the top left, they can just click on that little X button there and remove that from the facet string that they've looked at. And now we've got another 47 items showing, and now there's videos and a few other things in that list. So the client is able to make quite sophisticated choices just by clicking on a string at the top.
Couple more minutes.
Okay. Also, just to show you, we can do more traditional searching and couple that with facets. Someone can type in quilting on the home page, as I've done there. They'll then get some facets on the left that are subsets of the quilting environment. You'll also notice now that because we're out of DVDs, we're into books. There's lots more book covers on. So we're just pulling this out of Amazon, and they're appearing on the left there. Someone can then choose patchwork quilts, which apparently is a different heading to quilting, so we can do that. And now they've got a query, quilting and patchwork quilts. And then finally, show holdings, the arrow there on the left. If they click on that, it does a real-time lookup into our circulation system and brings up the holdings that we have and gives you the status of doing that. So all this is happening at the last minute. The circulation data is live as of a few seconds ago when this was run. And then finally, the little circle there is where they can go in and place a reservation to it. And then we throw them back into the ILMS. Beyond that, what we're doing too is moving to what so far we're just calling a gateway. That's just an OPAC, which is our using that software to deliver the holdings in our catalog. We have other library resources and images database, etc. So we want to bring forward a new interface which gives you a single one-stop shop to do that. Here, some more interesting questions come up because we don't really know how to rank and how to work with queries that come from different systems. For example, if you're looking for Mount Wellington and you get an image of Mount Wellington, a musical score about Mount Wellington, and there is such a thing, and books about Mount Wellington, how do you rank those three? I have no idea yet. We have a lot of work to do in the future to find out. Finally, developing what I'm calling OPAC 2.0 is, in fact, within this gateway environment, let's pull data into it from outside the library as well and other resources. I know Tony's going to talk about, I think, putting information into Google. I think the other question is equally valid. How can we pull Google into our OPACs and provide that type of result within what people are doing already within our own boundaries? So, finally, three summary slides. The really important thing, I think, for us to do is treat our users as real people. They accept good enough. In fact, they only really want good enough. And even more importantly, they'll probably only pay for good enough. So when you're trying to go to funding authorities, saying you're really a perfect type of cataloguing isn't going to be enough. You're going to have to say that you actually deliver good value. Users will move to where they can. They'll select what they think is best, not what we think is best. And we need to be proactive. Really importantly, I think, for all of us, we need to think about data just as a commodity. It has no intrinsic value unless it contributes to our outcomes. We need to create the right data, and we need to share the right data. If you look at all the evaluative information and usage data we have across all our libraries, we should be able to give really good indicative information to patrons who are trying to get information about a given resource. They don't have to go to Amazon to get their rankings or somebody else's rankings. We as libraries should be able to rank, get a rankings engine, if you like, going quite well. Finally, summary three, I don't think the OPAC is dead, and I'm quite positive about it, but I think it's going to be librarians who move it forward. And we as librarians are going to have to sort of not rely on LMS systems to do it. We're going to have to do it ourselves. We're going to have to take risks, and importantly, we're going to have to make mistakes, but continue to move forward. Finally, if we start out with our version of Alcatraz, what I'd like to see is it move to that, where it becomes really the center of what a lot of people are doing, not something far off in the distance. And I think that is quite possible. Thank you.